It's time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Welcome to Sleep Science Today, the show where we talk about sleep and the science behind sleep. My name is Andrew Kolsky. I'm your host. I'm actually a behavioral sleep medicine clinician, so I practice what I preach here. And today we're going to be talking about a new topic that we have not covered, and it's called idiopathic hypersomnia. Kind of a strange word, but we're going to learn what that means. We have two guests joining us today. We've got Matt Horsnell, that some of you may recognize from a previous show, and we've got Diana Kimmel. So I'm going to ask you each to please introduce yourselves. Matt, why don't you go first?
Yeah, so my name is Matt Horsnell, and I am a person living with narcolepsy with cataplexy. That's also known as NT1. I've been living with this condition since I was about 12, diagnosed at age 25. I'm an author advocate, and I've been trying to really increase awareness about all central disorders of hypersomnolence, and have been very active with Diana and with the Hypersomnia Foundation to raise awareness about this sister condition, if you will.
Fantastic, fantastic. So I was going to say, you know, you mentioned the word narcolepsy, and it's like, wait, that's not idiopathic hypersomnia, but we're going to learn more about that. So Diana, you're up.
Hi, I'm Diana Kimmel. I'm a person living with idiopathic hypersomnia. I am an advocate, and I'm also a board member with the Hypersomnia Foundation.
Fantastic. Well, thank you both for being here, and we're going to learn more about all of these things as we go through today's show. So let's start off with some of the basics here. What is idiopathic hypersomnia? Just give us some background here. What are we talking about?
Sure. Idiopathic hypersomnia is a sleep disorder. I best explain it by, you can sleep all night. You can sleep, you know, you can take a nap and you still feel unrefreshed. You feel exhausted. You don't feel like you got any sleep at all. It's kind of like putting your iPhone on the charger all night, and you wake up and it's still at 10%.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So there's a lot of questions in there to follow up with. But let me ask Matt. Matt, can you contrast or compare for us the difference between what Diana just shared and narcolepsy that you are living with?
Yeah, you know, one of the common threads that we both share is that we both experience excessive daytime sleepiness. We know significantly more about what causes narcolepsy type 1 than we do what causes IH. But that common thread really is EDS. One of the prominent physicians in the space, Anne-Marie Morse, likes to call narcolepsy a disease of wakefulness or a disorder of wakefulness, and idiopathic hypersomnia a disorder of sleepiness. And while those two statements sound, you know, fairly similar, there's actually a world of difference in terms of like how it could potentially make you feel. I have trouble staying awake, and Diana and other people with IH have trouble waking up and staying and transitioning out of that sleep state. So there's a huge Venn diagram. I'll be happy to send that to you as well, that kind of does a good job of showing those overlaps between NT1, NT2, which is narcolepsy without cataplexy, and IH. But the one thing we share in common is we are both really, really sleepy people, and it requires some really skilled approaches at living life to live our best version of ourselves.
Right, right. But real quick, can you explain, you used the word cataplexy. What does that mean? Mm-hmm.
So cataplexy is a symptom that's completely unique to narcolepsy type 1. And so cataplexy is an involuntary loss of muscle tone. It can be partial, so like slurred speech, slack jaw, knee buckling, and it's associated primarily with an emotional response. So laughter, elation, anger, startle is a big trigger for me. And each person's own triggers vary. So it's hard to do, say, cut and dry, but we do typically associate it with emotional responses. Also, as I'm sleepier, I'm more likely to experience cataplexy. And if you think about emotions being on the surface when you're sleepy, it does kind of make some intuitive sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then my last question for you for clarification is, you've mentioned narcolepsy type 1. How many types are there, and what's the difference?
Yeah, so you've got the narcolepsy type 1, which is with cataplexy, and then narcolepsy type 2, which is almost all of the symptoms except for the cataplexy piece to it. And so those are the two main types. However, when you talk about central disorders of hypersomnolence, or CDH, you also include IH on that spectrum of sleepiness symptoms. It's a completely different condition itself, but it's all kind of on that same sleepiness spectrum in terms of how it's related.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thanks for clarifying. So let me jump over to Diana for a second here, because you're the one who is living with idiopathic hypersomnia. So, you know, we're using these words hypersomnolence and hypersomnia and all that. So can you share with us what the heck are we talking about, number one, when we use that word? And then number two, Diana, if you could share with us, how did you find out that you even had something called idiopathic hypersomnia?
So hypersomnolence, actually, Matt might need to press on that one. Hypersomnia, to me, I feel like it's hypersleepy. Like, I'm just oversleepy. Matt, do you have a better?
Yeah. No, hypersomnolence is more of kind of the expression of sleepiness, and hypersomnia is kind of what your condition is. There's some very nuanced definition differences between hypersomnia or hypersomnolence disorder underneath the DSM, or the criteria used for psychologists, versus the international classification of sleep disorders, the ICSD-3, that mm-hmm. looks at the difference between, like, what is IH. So there's some very nuanced difference there. For the sake of today's discussion, I think looking at the ICSD-3 idiopathic hypersomnia definition is probably practical, because that's what we're talking about with most of these conditions. But there is some debate on which one's best. Do you look at the DSM version? Do you look at the ICSD-3? And, you know, that's a rabbit hole that we could go down and probably never come out of. But again, the hypersomnolence and hypersomnia are often used interchangeably. And so for the sake of the conversation, probably just we can stick with hypersomnia in terms of describing the condition for sure.
Great, great. All right, so let's...
I handed that off to him. He does an amazing job of explaining that, and I will...
Thank you.
Yeah, he does.
Yes.
So I was going to say, so now that we've gotten sort of the science and the geek stuff out of the way, now, Diana, tell us the reality. Give us your story.
Yeah, you know, growing up, I was always the kid that everybody talked about of, wow, she's just, you know, she knows when she's tired, she'll go to sleep, even if it's 6 o'clock at night. And that... I mean, I remember being 8, 9, 10, 11, you know, hearing that over and over again and just being tired and exhausted. You know, then growing up, you know, teenage years, it was always explained that you're doing too much. You know, you just don't sleep and, you know, things like that. It was probably my 20s where I just knew something was not right. I just never felt refreshed. I always experienced something like brain fog, where I just felt like I was socked in. I felt like I was almost walking through jello. Like I was just not functioning any better than just the bare minimum, just trying to get by. I did talk to doctors, and it was always explained of, you know, well, you just had kids, you know, you're just sleepy. Well, no, this has been going on since I was a kid. Oh, lose a little weight, eat better, do this. I was always just pushed off. It was never taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Just time and time again. So it progressed. I did start finding ways to, I guess, fake it till I made it. I surface lived. I did what I had to do to get by each day. And then it got to the point where it was winning. I would sit and lay down any chance I got. And then with nobody believing me, especially the medical profession, that, you know, every doctor I was seeing, mm-hmm. I was embarrassed about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would, you know, somebody came, you know, in the house, one of my kids, I would just jump up, you know, try to, you know, act like nothing was wrong. And that's how I was living for years. Till it got to the point where I just could not hide it anymore. I wasn't ever feeling refreshed. I actually had a car accident where I fell asleep behind the wheel.
Oh, gosh.
Even then, nobody was taking it serious as a sleep disorder. Uh-huh. I did sleep apnea so that I wasn't going to be looked at. So I certainly must have had a seizure.
Wow.
I went through another year and a half trying to convince them that there's something else was wrong, taking high doses of seizure medicines, and still having attacks constantly, not feeling refreshed. So I think what you're hearing here is it's just a journey of begging for someone to listen to you over and over again. And then you stop even talking about it because you're not getting anywhere with it. After that accident, after the year and a half, I'm one of the lucky ones where I kind of stumbled into a place where my sleep person found me. There was some research going on at Emory, and a clinician kind of flagged them that this, I think this is someone that you're, you know, of idiopathic hypersomnia, you know, that she's presenting just like that. So it actually took me, I was always sent for the one night study, not the whole MSLT.
Right.
So I had four, you know, overnight studies. And it wasn't until finally, you know, a sleep doctor familiar with idiopathic hypersomnia sent me for that MSLT. And it became very clear that I was positive for this. My, you know, I was falling asleep in, you know, under 4 minutes, under 2 minutes, you know, under 6 minutes. My longest time to fall asleep, you know, we joke about to this day because we forget about it, but it was over 8 minutes, but under nine. That's only because I had a spinal tap in between the two naps.
Oh, my gosh.
And I still fell asleep that quickly, even with that adrenaline and all that stuff going on. So,
yeah. Wow. Wow. Okay. Well, there's a lot there that I want to follow up with. But let me just, for purposes of our discussion here and for the audience's sake, you know, number one, and you've probably heard me talk about this on other shows if you've listened to the show, in the United States, for whatever reason, we're getting much, much better about sleep and sleep medicine education, but we're still at a place where a lot of your primary care physicians really haven't had the opportunity to learn much or anything about sleep, so it's hard for them to know what to do. Same for the psychologists, for the mental health practitioners. It's not something that's covered in school. So it's something that's new that people are starting to learn about. So you have a lot of people like Diana who have a sleep issue, but nobody's diagnosing it because they don't have any frame of reference to even know what to look for. My colleagues that I've spoken to over in Europe, they tend to tell me differently. They say that that's just a common thing that all doctors ask about is your sleep. So it's really interesting to see that difference. The other thing I wanted to comment on is because of that, we eventually, like Diana did, find a sleep doctor through our journey, and then they have these tests. And one of the tests is called polysomnography, and that's where you go in and you get hooked up to, looks like, all these wires. And it actually, there's nothing stuck in you. It doesn't hurt at all. But they monitor you for a night, and typically that's where they're going to find most sleep disorders, including sleep apnea and other things. However, then she mentioned MSLT, and that's called the multiple sleep latency test. And really that one is about, they're going to have you throughout the day go to sleep and see how long it takes for you to fall asleep. And this is where she was saying just a few minutes and she would fall asleep, whereas someone without this issue, they'd be awake because they're awake during the day. So just wanted to put all that in context. You know, it's really good that people are now starting to become aware of the sleep issues and all. So let me ask you, Diana, so when you wake up now, okay, you've gone to bed, you've slept X number of hours, you wake up, are you waking up because you're naturally waking up? Are you waking up because an alarm tells you to wake up? And whenever you wake up, whichever way, do you feel refreshed at all?
Well, if you would have asked me that question 3 years ago versus now, I'm on a medicine regimen that's giving me some relief and helping me wake up a little bit more refreshed and, you know, getting a little bit higher quality of sleep. Now, 3 years ago before the first, actually, I think it might be a little longer than that, but the first medicine that was FDA approved, because we have to have FDA approval for a medicine to be prescribed for idiopathic hypersomnia. No, I was waking up exhausted. I actually had to stop working because I just, there was no way I could do something for 8 hours a day on, you know, Monday through Friday. You know, can I do things? Yes, I have to do them at my hours that are better each day, and they may not be the same. They may be 3 days apart before I feel better. So no, I was not waking up refreshed. I would have, like I said, the intense brain fog. You have like word retrievals, hallucinations. It's really a horrible way to live. You know, somebody says, well, I just don't understand what you're saying. And I say, you know, next time you get stung by a bee and you take that Benadryl and a couple things a day, that's how I feel. You know, can I get up and do a couple things? Yes. Do I feel like I need to sit down and lay down? Do I feel sluggish? That's how I feel.
Wow. Wow. All right. So I want to jump over to Matt in just a second here to sort of compare and contrast. But first, we need to take a break for a commercial. So we will be right back on Sleep Science Today, and we're going to keep talking about idiopathic hypersomnia, and we're going to talk about how that compares with narcolepsy. So be right back. Have you ever wondered why you can't sleep well? Well, there could be lots of different reasons. In order to figure it out, I wrote the book, Why Can't I Sleep Well? It includes 150 common sleep questions that are asked and answered, and I provide all of the supporting science and evidence to address each of the questions. I encourage you to get a copy of Why Can't I Sleep Well by Andrew Kolsky. It's available at www.sleepsciencetoday.com.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, we're back on Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're talking about idiopathic hypersomnia. Matt, my question for you is, you've heard Diana describe what she deals with on a daily basis, and you've mentioned that you have narcolepsy. Can you sort of compare and contrast so we can understand the difference?
Yeah, so the diagnostic journey actually has a lot of similarities in terms of looking for answers and not getting them from the medical community. You know, I saw a pediatrician, internal medicine doctor, and four psychiatrists all presenting with sleepiness, and they all failed to refer or get me to a sleep study. So ultimately, I took it upon myself to thinking I had sleep apnea to go find a sleep specialist. And ultimately, you know, I had a definitive MSLT like Diana. Important kind of compare and contrast. The thing that our MSLTs share in common is that we all average under 8 minutes, less than or equal to 8 minutes for that time to sleep. Now, people with narcolepsy will jump into REM sleep. Sometimes they can count one of the REM episodes from overnight, but typically just looking at the MSLT, and you jump into REM sleep in two of the naps, and there's a time threshold. You're not supposed to go to REM sleep for about 90 to 100 minutes, you know, after you fall asleep. So if you're jumping into REM that quickly in a nap, that's a sign. And two of those is a sign that you have narcolepsy, and then cataplexy being self-reported. You know, when I hear Diana talk, you know, that there's so many similarities, but there are some nuanced differences. You know, the, from what I understand, and Diana can speak to this a little bit more from personal experience, there's that really profound sleep inertia that comes with living with IH. As a person with narcolepsy, I have what I consider mild sleep inertia. comparatively, where it takes me about 15 to 30 minutes to get my wits about me to be remotely conversational. I do benefit from restorative naps, refreshing naps, if you will. I don't ever wake up and feel like I can, you know, fight a bear, but I still wake up and I'm like, okay, that nap had a benefit, net positive for me throughout the day. So those are kind of some subtle differences there. The disrupted nighttime sleep piece with narcolepsy is particularly pronounced compared to IH. So while Diana's sleep efficiency score is incredibly high, as most people with IH would be, my sleep efficiency score is relatively low. So I'm coming out of sleep constantly, and I've got a hypnogram that looks like a seismograph. Like, it's just all over the place. So, you know, again, there's some very real differences, but overall, it's, you know, when you how you feel throughout the day, there's that significant overlap. One of the things, too, when you talk about MSLT for narcolepsy, test-retest reliability is relatively high. We're talking about like 85%, whereas unfortunately for IH, you're looking at somewhere about a coin flip on test-retest reliability. And so it's particularly challenging for my peers with IH to go in and search for an answer. And, you know, let's say you average out 8.5 minutes or 9 minutes or even 10 minutes. Does that mean that you don't have a sleep problem or that you don't potentially have IH? It would exclude you based on the criteria, but it doesn't necessarily mean that there's not anything, you know, wrong with you. The people with narcolepsy, particularly when they're treated, have a normal sleep volume overnight. That sleep quality is garbage, if you will, but that sleep quantity is approximate. I average about 8.5 to 9 hours of sleep per night. And I know some of my IH friends have long sleep, and then some of them have normal sleep. I would never say they have short sleep. So you've got the long sleep phenotype that's very pronounced versus a normal sleep. But the end result is the same. They wake up and they don't feel like they've slept a lick. And that's kind of the experience they have. Now, I'm not bouncing out of bed, but I can wake up at 6:30 in the morning with only some mild curse words. Whereas, again, some of my IH peers, I know it's a struggle. And there's probably some we use the word I'm sorry often in my house for how daddy acts in the morning trying to get my son ready for school. But I know some IH peers who that weight is a lot heavier.
Right.
Yeah. There are some people who, I mean, will sleep through 3 and 4 alarms. It's not odd to have an IH or have, you know, 5, 6, 7 alarms to wake them up in the morning, you know, 5, 10 minutes apart, just to try to get them out of bed. And, Matt talked about, you know, naps being refreshing. My nap is not refreshing. 9 times out of 10, if I take a nap, I will feel worse when I wake up than when I went to sleep. Now that doesn't mean I can't take naps or I won't take naps. Sometimes I am just seized by a nap. I'm done. It has consumed me to the point where I just can no longer, you know, be awake. But I can almost guarantee I will wake up worse. The sleep inertia after a nap is just, it's horrible. I would, for the next couple, it would take me hours to get out of a sleep inertia out of a nap. You know, I'm going to the cabinet. I know I want Oreos, but I open the refrigerator. You know, I say I need to put this can on, you know, in the garbage can, and I will literally walk over and put this can, you know, in the cabinet. Mm-hmm. I just almost don't even know. I can't grasp words. I can't even think properly.
Wow.
But like I said, it's not like I'm not going to be refreshed after that nap, but I can't even continue to go on without the nap.
So that, wow, because my next question to you was going to be your advice for someone with idiopathic hypersomnia. Should they then avoid napping? But it sounds like there's no choice, really.
Yeah. Well, and each person's a little different. Some people, you know, they'll fall asleep and they'll sleep, you know, 3, 4 hours. Other people will sleep like an hour. But across the board, most people never feel refreshed after a nap. But like I said, if you have to take it, it's no longer safe for you to try to function at night. You can't function anymore.
Right.
You have to. And even if I'm awake, there would be times where, I'm awake, I'm not napping, but I'm not worth anything, you know? I certainly wouldn't, you know, do something that, I wouldn't balance my checkbook, you know?
Right. Wow. Okay. So here's a question, I don't know, maybe Matt, you're the one that wants to answer, whoever wants to answer this one. So I can imagine that somebody listening to this might say, well, how do you know that you're just not fatigued then? You know, maybe you're just working too hard and trying to do too much in a day. What's the difference?
You know, that's a great question. And to be honest, I don't know if physicians could answer that very well, let alone patients. But I the way that I've used as an analogy is, when I'm incredibly sleepy, I'm sitting, if I'm on the couch, I don't want to get up, but I can get up. When I'm incredibly fatigued, I don't want to get up, and physically I can't get up. My body weighs more than it feels like. It feels like gravity is increasing over me. Also, my response to physical activity changes. Instead of, you know, when I'm fatigued, if I do, you know, a moderate workout, everything is harder. And that's another nuanced difference between PWNs and PWIH. PWNs can respond well to exercise, whereas PWIH have that post-exertional malaise that can linger for a while afterwards, depends on the individual. But the fatigue to me is a physical sensation, and it's, you know, an exhaustion, whereas for me, sleepiness is slightly nuanced in terms of, like, I can push through, I can get up, so some slight differences. But again, it's tricky. I would say that it presents, patients will present saying that they're fatigued, and sometimes they mean that they're sleepy. And that's why it's so important to have really good follow-up from your physician to say, let's talk more about that. Are you actually sleepy? Let's look at some of the different, you know, validated tools to measure some of that. But it also, it's not impossible that you have, you know, a condition that's triggering fatigue in addition to something that's triggering your sleep disorder as well. So, you know, hormonal sex hormones in particular can be, you know, have demonstrative impacts on your fatigue level. And so having that continuing ongoing conversation, just because you get a sleep disorder doesn't mean that everything's related to that sleep disorder ad infinitum. It's important that you have those good dialogue with your physician.
Yeah. And then, you know, God forbid you have some sort of a, you know, two things at once, some co-occurring disorder, then really trying to figure out what's triggering what can be challenging. Let's just put it that way. Yeah. So we have a pretty good understanding of the two different disorders, narcolepsy and idiopathic hypersomnia. So let's talk about, okay, so now maybe I realize that, you know, one of those sounds like me, and I go and I find a sleep doctor and I get checked out, and lo and behold, yep, I've got idiopathic hypersomnia or whatever it may be. I'd love to hear from each of you in your cases, what do you do about it? So let's start with you, Matt, with narcolepsy.
Yeah.
What do you do about it? How do you function?
So, you know, Project Sleep's identified what they call the four pillars of narcolepsy management. So you have medications, and there's a number of different kinds of medications. There's nighttime sleep aids. There's old school stimulants, wakefulness promoters. There's something called a histamine inverse agonist. And they have a new class under investigation called an orexin agonist. So that's one of your pillars is medications. The other pillar, you have naps. So for me, that's scheduled naps and rescue naps. That third pillar is going to be lifestyle adjustments. So physical activity, making sure that I'm getting sufficient sleep, quality and quantity, as much as I can possibly control that. So consistency for me is very key. Diet, nutrition, and, you know, that physical activity. I love to lift weights. That's not for everybody. Find the activity that works for you. And then that fourth pillar is going to be behavioral support. So interventions, whether it be with a therapist, some small groups, and social support. And that can be, again, online small groups. It can also be just connecting on social media, but finding peers that you can both share your experiences and glean from their wisdom. So it's kind of a balanced approach. But again, the most important thing is to have that, find the right sleep physician, find somebody that listens to you and that you have a healthy relationship with, because ultimately that's kind of going to be your cheerleader and your your starting point, and then build your community. Those are kind of the two, like, let's get it ball rolling. Those are the suggestions I would have.
Fantastic. Thank you. I appreciate that. I love the sort of four-step process. It makes it easy to remember. So Diana, what about you? What would you say?
Well, mine's pretty easy because it's just about the same. Things that make us different is there's a lot more medications available to somebody with narcolepsy, one or two. Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about narcolepsy one and two. Well, narcolepsy 2 and idiopathic hypersomnia are incredibly close. There's even talks, are they the same thing, or is it a syndrome of some sort? But somebody with an N2 diagnosis has access to all of those medicines that Matt has.
Right.
Somebody with IH has far less. So I present almost just like somebody with N2. Right down to having sleep paralysis and things like that. Mm-hmm. But when my doctor goes to prescribe it, 9 times out of 10, you'll get denied by insurance. So stimulants are often used to help, and they do help some people. But I've always been, my insurance will deny a stimulant because I don't have ADHD or narcolepsy.
Wow.
Most medicines, when they first come to the market, are not approved for IH, but they are approved for narcolepsy 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. So there, when you get this diagnosis, it's incredibly frustrating to have IH. Mm-hmm. It's like, you do. I will tell anybody that says, I'm just newly diagnosed, well, get on social media, meet other people. Get on the hypersomniafoundation.org website. Learn everything you can. But when you start seeing all of these medications that are available, but you can't get them, or wow, you can pay out of pocket for them, things like that. Right. So that is where, and Matt touched on this, where support is so important.
Yeah.
Finding that person that you can talk to. Online is fabulous. Phone is fabulous. Meeting somebody in person, it changes your life. Matt and I are the same and we're different. But when I see him, I automatically feel like I'm not alone. Somebody totally understands me. It's like my big sleep big brother kind of thing,
Right.
That is just such a large part of having a sleep disorder, because I've gone through stages of having a sleep disorder where it's embarrassing. I'm misunderstood. I'm considered lazy. Even having a medicine right now that is helping me has not cured me.
Right.
Something that makes a normal person tired is going to exhaust me. Is it high emotions? Is it stress? Is it a menstrual cycle? So I can be going along pretty good, but any change in my schedule, can just send me into, days and weeks of just being unable to control my sleepiness and my wakefulness. I always say, it's a sleep disorder. It really dictates what I can do all the hours that I'm awake.
Right. Well, let me stop us here because I've got to take another commercial break. But when we come back, I want to talk more about some more resources. So we'll be right back on Sleep Science Today. Have you ever wondered why you can't sleep well? Well, there could be lots of different reasons. In order to figure it out, I wrote the book, Why Can't I Sleep Well? It includes 150 common sleep questions that are asked and answered, and I provide all of the supporting science and evidence to address each of the questions. I encourage you to get a copy of Why Can't I Sleep Well by Andrew Kolsky. It's available at www.sleepsciencetoday.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, welcome back to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're talking about idiopathic hypersomnia and, by default, narcolepsy as well, because of the crossover and the comparisons between the two. So we've heard about what it is, we've heard about how it impacts us, and now we were talking about sort of community, I guess I'll use that word, meeting with others, understanding what it's like, being able to talk to another human being who experiences the same thing. And one of the things we said in the beginning is Diana is a board member with the Hypersomnia Foundation. So maybe you can tell us, Diana, what exactly is the Hypersomnia Foundation? What do they do? Is it for doctors? Is it for patients? Give us the whole background.
Well, it has a little bit for everybody. If you're a patient, it has things for you. If you're a supporter, if you're a researcher, if you're a medical professional. We try to cover everything. We try to connect people with idiopathic hypersomnia and their supporters with each other. We do annual conferences where you can meet in person. We also offer free virtual attendance to that if you can't travel to that location. This year in June, we're going to Seattle. So we do that every year. Throughout the year, we do something called Unite, which is offered once a month. We usually have a guest speaker. Matt actually helps us at the foundation run that, and he does an amazing job of, you know, getting information out there, making people feel comfortable and heard and understood, and, you know, just connecting with that. So that's once a month. Twice during the year, we usually have another online event, maybe a half a day conference. And we try to connect the community with speakers, newest research going on, mental health help and resources. Mm-hmm. On our website, really check it out, hypersomniafoundation.org. We have everything from, you know, definitions of some of the things that we spoke about today that, you know, you just don't know and you have never heard about before. Research opportunities. We have a physician's directory. A lot of stuff, information. We have a video section, YouTube, of past conferences, past speakers, all types of things. All, you know, if you're looking for it, it's most likely at that foundation's website. Mm-hmm. I also say there are other great organizations. You know, mm-hmm. we mentioned Project Sleep. There's Wake Up Narcolepsy. Hypersomnolence Australia. You know,
oh, wow.
Wherever you can get information, wherever you can connect with somebody, that is just extremely important. Actually, Julie Flagar, I heard her say, was one of the first things I heard, you know, over 11, 12 years ago when I was diagnosed, was, you know, if your doctor is not telling you to reach, get out there and get support, social, you know, from a foundation, get information, they're doing you as a disservice. They're not giving you that other piece that you need to live with narcolepsy or idiopathic hypersomnia.
Right. Wow. Well, I do want to follow up on one thing you said. You said, you know, because we're talking about sort of connecting people, and you said that you have or the Hypersomnia Foundation has an annual conference. Is that for people living with, hypersomnia type of conditions?
Absolutely. It's for, we gear it towards the patient and the supporter. Mm-hmm. We also... You'll hear Matt and I, you know, we may have a different diagnosis, but a lot of what we're dealing with is the same and a lot of how we deal with it is the same. So we open it up to narcolepsy patients as well. And we'll bring in, like I said, researchers, medical professionals. And one thing I will say is any medical professional or researcher that comes and speaks at our conferences, they are unbelievably willing to talk to any patient, connect with them, you know, give them some free time on the sidebar. It is so important. If you can get to a conference, that's what you're going to do. We mm-hmm. also make it a primary thing to do is to give the patients and the supporters time to connect with each other. We want you to leave with a support village when you leave one of our conferences. We want you to feel like you have somebody. For me, the best thing I hear when a person comes to the conference for the first time and they say to me, I can't believe how accepted I feel, how understood I feel, and this has just been an amazing experience. Mm-hmm. So it is primarily for people with.
So let me ask this then. We are recording this episode in the beginning of May of 2025. I believe you have a conference coming up. Is that correct? Can you tell us when it is and where it is?
It is it's June. I think it's the 5th, 6th, and 7th. It is in Seattle, Washington this year. We start Friday night already with a meet and greet. We want you to already start connecting with other board members, you know, other speakers that have already arrived, whether they're a researcher or a doctor. Saturday is a full day. Sunday is a half a day. We use a platform for our conferences, which is very beneficial for somebody with sleep disorder. It gives you the ability to watch it virtually as well. So if I get a little tired halfway through and I want to go up and lay in bed, I can now watch it on my phone. Right. Once we upload those videos, you can watch it for up to 3 months.
Wow.
So we make it as accessible as possible. Like I said, virtually, it is a free ticket to mm-hmm. watch. We keep our ticket prices in person as low as possible, $50 a person, maybe $25 extra family members.
Right.
If you can't make Seattle, we do these every year in June.
Fantastic.
You'll find all that information. So once a year, you can guarantee there's an opportunity. Next year, we'll be in Baltimore.
Oh, okay. So you're going coast to coast, basically.
We actually follow the sleep meeting. So we go where they go.
Great. Okay, so that's resources for idiopathic hypersomnia. Matt, are there additional resources for narcolepsy that people should know about?
Yeah, as Diana alluded to, there's a lot of great overlap. So most of the resources you'll find at HF are going to be directly translatable to narcolepsy as well. And there are actually great narcolepsy features as well. Project Sleep has been a home for all sleep disorders as well, from sleep apnea to narcolepsy to IH to Klein-Levin to the REM behavior disorder. Basically, if it's exists in the sleep disorder space, Project Sleep tries to help raise awareness on it. So they're a great resource, originally founded by a person with narcolepsy. Wake Up Narcolepsy has tremendous online social support groups. So, Unite's a once a month feature. And it also has some, I think twice a month features, which is for support people. Wake Up Narcolepsy has about 6 days a week of groups that happen at any given time. So in all likelihood, you're going to be able to find and connect with a group that fits with your schedule. Those are all virtual. So you can be in your pajamas. You can be sitting in your bed. It doesn't matter. Just show up. And they're purposefully inclusive of people with IH as well as people with narcolepsy. Or if you are a support person, or even if you're looking for a diagnosis or an answer. So those are kind of my big three in terms of looking for support and resources. And that's where I would go. And they also have great relationships with their professionals in terms of connecting you with great data, great presentations from leading experts in both the behavioral sleep space and also the HCP, the clinical aspect and the broad researcher base as well. So some really good just clearing houses. And, if you're looking for something, you can also check both. But, Project Sleep and HF have great resources online. So if you're looking for, we call them nerd alerts in Project Sleep. So if you want to nerd out on a particular topic, you can probably find that with a printout. It's going to be like your show. It's going to also be available through YouTube and a podcast as well. So they're trying to meet people where they are and how they consume information. And so really great outlets, and then you can follow those sites as well on YouTube. As Diana mentioned, the app that they use will put forth the data for 3 months, and then afterwards that typically migrates onto YouTube. So you've got some great, evergreen content. As research changes, you may want to watch a more up-to-date one, but for the most part, that research that's presented will also be relatable a couple of years later.
Wow, fantastic. Well, we have reached our time limit for the show today. But we covered a lot of stuff here, and I really appreciate each of you taking your time to share your experiences and share your information with the audience, because, you know, there may very well be people out there who are trying to figure out, why am I always so tired? And the answer may be because you might not have been diagnosed and you may have idiopathic hypersomnia. So for the audience, we encourage you to help us spread the word about Sleep Science Today, where we bring you these important topics and try and educate you. The best way you can do that is tell your friends, come to our website, sleepsciencetoday.com, sign up for our mailing list, newsletter, good information, lots of stuff like that. We don't do any spam. We don't try to sell you anything. We're just giving legitimate scientific content. And you can also find us on our YouTube channel at Sleep Science Today and on all the different podcast networks. You will find us out there at Sleep Science Today. So please tell your friends. The more support we have, the more we can do this, the more information we can put out. So thank you again. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and we'll see you on an upcoming episode of Sleep Science Today.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, sleep science today and sleep better tonight.